From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For some, the Christian allegories C.S. Lewis embedded in his Chronicles of Narnia are what give those books their resonance and meaning. For others, these themes are overbearing or annoying. When she first encountered The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Laura Miller didn't notice any of that. And later, when she did, she felt betrayed. Miller describes her relationship to Narnia as rocky as any love affair, a story of enchantment, estrangement, and reunion. Yes, she returned to the stories and has written a book about it. It's an exploration of just what it was that captivated her about Narnia as a child. The book is an exploration of the pleasures of reading as a child and how it shapes our lives. It's called The Magician's Book, and Laura Miller will join us today to talk about it after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her work, The Magician's Book, the literary critic Laura Miller describes her relationship to Narnia in C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia as rocky as any love affair. It's a story, she writes, of enchantment, betrayal, estrangement, and reunion. For some, the Christian allegories C.S. Lewis embedded in his Chronicles are what give the books their meaning, but for others, these themes are simplistic or overbearing. When she first encountered The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Miller didn't notice any of that. She didn't see any of the religious themes in any of the seven books in the series. And later, when she did, she says she felt betrayed. Eventually, she returned to the stories, and she's written about it. It's an exploration of just what it was that captivated her about Narnia. The book is an exploration of the pleasures of reading as a child and how all of this shapes our lives. The book is called The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia, and Laura Miller is joining us today to talk about it. Laura Miller is co-founder of Salon.com. She continues as a staff writer there. She's also a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, and she's joining us today from New York City. And Laura Miller, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to begin, as you do in the book, with what you describe as one of the most vivid memories from your childhood. And as you explain it, nothing much really happens. You're just standing there thinking. Talk about that.
Well, I remember this moment with that strange clarity that you have for certain strange little moments in your childhood where maybe not that much happened, but for some reason an experience of a certain point in your life is crystallized in that moment. And I remember standing in this very sunny neighborhood where I grew up. I can still see the corner in my mind in the suburbs and just thinking, I have to go to Narnia. If I don't go, I think I'm just going to die. I just can't stand it. I'll never be happy if I don't get to go there. What can I do? I have to do something. There's nothing that I can do. I have no idea how to get there. It was very, you know, it was probably one of the, I suppose the reason why I remember it so clearly is that it was a such a strong, pure emotion in that moment. And that's what really fixes it in your memory.
Can you explain why it is you wanted to go there? Is it because it seemed entirely possible that there was such a place?
Well, I think that, you know, part of it was the child's mind that people often talk about where they don't have the same firm division between fantasy and reality, and anybody who knows children is familiar with the way that they kind of go back and forth between, they'll tell you that the deer in the backyard actually spoke to them earlier in the day and told them that he really does like children after all.
Right.
And and you tell them a story and then they think it's true. And so part of it was that. But at this point, I was probably about 9 years old and I really knew better. I think it was just that I wanted it so badly. Mm. I couldn't see how if it wasn't true, it was just going to sort of break the world in half for me.
You dedicate the book to your second grade teacher, Willan Belden, who gave you a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It wasn't, as you've described, it wasn't as part of a school project. It was something she just kind of gave you privately. And she said to you that she figured you were a child who needed to read C.S. Lewis.
I don't remember what she told me at the time. You know, I remember her handing me the book, and I remember what it looked like, and then taking it home, and then just sort of falling into it, and having this tremendous, it was a tremendous revelation. It was only later, when I interviewed her for writing The Magician's Book, that she told me she told me why. Because, when grown-ups do things like that when you're a child, you don't ever say why. I mean, their motives are unimaginable to you.
Of course.
But when I was finally able to ask her, she said, well, you just needed to read that. And the startling thing that I learned is that even though this was the late 60s when she handed me this book, she had read it when it first came out, and I was the first child that she had ever given it to. Yeah. So she clearly had really good instincts in that way. Mm. She did pick somebody who completely and totally responded to it.
There's this thing she told you when you were talking to her later about all of this that I wanted to ask you about. You told her that, and she says she will always remember this. She'll never forget. You said that you didn't know there were other people who had the kind of imagination you had. What were you telling her?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the weird things about writing a book about your childhood, if you aren't one of those people who sits around thinking about their childhood a lot, is that often you wind up thinking about your earlier self or talking to people about your earlier self, and she just seems like another person. She seems like a separate person from me.
Yeah.
And someone will say, you said this and you said that, and in my mind I'm thinking, she said that and she said this. I developed a relationship with my child self because I had not spent, the whole earlier part of my life sort of telling myself stories about how the child I was became the adult I was. I think like a lot of memoirists, I'm not really a memoirist as much as I am a critic.
Yeah.
And so I hadn't been sort of spinning that web between my child self and my adult self all my life. So I suddenly came back to this, trying to make sense of this childhood passion. And people were suddenly telling me all of these things that I had done that I didn't remember and I didn't know what they meant. And so I thought, when she told me that, what did that mean? What did that mean? It was as inaccessible to me as if a friend's daughter told me that. Mm. But I think that what I was saying is something that I've heard from a lot of people who have talked to me about their childhood relationship with these books. Since, when I started writing this book, which was that it wasn't so much that this was the discovery of something new, although it was that. It felt like a recognition. I felt that these were things that in some way I had almost already known were there and that inside me, and that C.S. Lewis was revealing these things to me or making them manifest in a way that no other writer had before that. It didn't feel like it was coming from outside as much as it was coming from inside. And I'm surprised by how many people have told me almost exactly the same thing. I knew this already, I felt. When I heard these stories, I felt I knew them already. Or there's a writer named Francis Spufford who wrote that C.S. Lewis had so perfectly described exactly everything that he wanted most in the world and life. And for the people who sort of glommed onto these books when they were children, that was the feeling, that it was just sort of created exactly for them.
You ask this question in the book, whether or not children who prefer books set in the real ordinary world read as obsessively as those who like fantasy worlds. What do you think the answer is?
My belief is probably the children who like fantasy worlds read more obsessively because they want to, for whatever reason, to get away from the world that they're in. And as much as maybe the stories of Ramona, or maybe it's The Babysitter's Club, or whatever your favorite books were as a child, as much as you might like those, they are always in a kind of dialogue with your actual life. You're thinking, oh, you know, that's like my friend or my parents or my pet or whatever. And so it's you know, it's like an annex to your everyday life as opposed to an entire other world.
But it's important to say, as you do in the book, that because people – you've heard people say that books with magic in them are a way of escaping reality, but you don't see it that way.
Well, they are a way of escaping reality, but they're not a way of escaping truth necessarily.
Right.
And there's a difference between those two things. And I think that – I did get a little bit of grief as a child for my interest in these sort of fantasy narratives, and the idea that they weren't relevant or that they represented, you know, trying to shirk my real life. But I, you know, you don't hear that so much anymore. I mean, that's a kind of a puritanical attitude that I don't think people have that much anymore. It, you know, really, there are all different kinds of stories, and stories about things that could never happen in the real world nevertheless have their own kind of truth. And that is something that you may instinctively understand as a child, but you can only really fully understand that as an adult. And one of the great things about going back to these books and really thinking about what they meant to me as a child in writing The Magician's Book was that, you know, I got that adult understanding. You know, I pursued it and I discovered all of these corners and dimensions of loving that kind of story that I had never really thought about before. Going back to myths and medieval allegories and contemporary, you know, fantasy and science fiction, I developed an understanding of how those stories work that really just enriched the whole experience for me.
I like how you talk about this escape from reality is you know, you said, you know, all stories are unrealistic. The good ones anyway are unrealistic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it sort of gets at this idea of what we want from art. You say we want something different. We want something with a shape or with a purpose. And real life doesn't always give us that.
No. I mean, what we want from stories is meaning.
Yeah.
And people get meaning from life and from experience in different ways. I mean, obviously for C.S. Lewis and a lot of the people who like the Narnia books, it might be religion. But if you're not a religious person, I think stories are a major source of that feeling of meaning. But that you're going to stories for it specifically because real experience, lived experience, doesn't necessarily have that. And that's really the sort of purpose of stories is to sort of shape experience in a way that makes sense to us. C.S. Lewis would say that he thought that fairy tales were less misleading or deceptive to children than what he called school stories, which were these sort of stories of boys at boarding schools, you know, having adventures and winning reputations for themselves in the school, because every child really knows that there are no such thing as dragons. But you could say about a school story or maybe even say a romance novel that they misrepresent reality in a way that's more deceptive for looking so much like reality, for mimicking reality too closely.
Mm. So at what point, Laura Miller, did you think enough about all of this to figure, I want to write about this. I want to create a book that reexamines all of this.
Well, I'm a staff writer at a website called Salon, and we were doing a package of essays where we had all different kinds of writers talk about books that had changed their lives. And people were picking, you know, like War and Peace or Lolita or whatever, you know, these kind of serious, artistic adult novels. And I was kind of thinking, well, what should be something I read when I was in college? And, you know, there were various things that I was considering. And then I said, well, you know, really the most transformative book in my life was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That book completely changed my life. It made a reader out of me and eventually led to my work and most of my friendships and some of the best experiences of my life by doing so. And so I really, if I'm going to write a book about a book that changed my life, it has to be this book. And then I had all this kind of strange mixture of feelings. I was a little embarrassed to be writing about a kid's book. And then, you know, I was writing about a book that changed my life that was written by a famous Christian apologist, but I'm not a Christian. And I had gone through a period of hating this book. Well, not hating it, but sort of breaking up with it in a way, because because when I had realized that, and so my history of it was so sort of tortured, but in a way that sort of all of our relationships to stories when reality doesn't turn out to be exactly like our favorite stories, and the more I thought about it, you know, at first it seemed kind of inappropriate, but really, that would be the honest thing. I mean, the honest answer to that question is that book. And I was trying to just really be honest. And then I realized the more I thought about it, the richer it became, you know, and it just, you could take layer after layer off of it. And at some point in thinking about this, I was going, oh, there's a whole book in this. There's a whole book about my relationship to this other book.
Mm. When did you realize that it was, although it is part memoir, of course, but when did you realize that at its essence, it's about how we read. It's about the experience of reading and how that experience is different when we're children and when we're adolescents and then when we're adults.
I think, you know, I started out wanting for it to be that, for it to be a book about reading, because I feel, as someone who spends a lot of time writing about books and as, you know, as a literary critic, everyone is so fixated on writers. Everyone wants to be a writer. Everyone, you know, thinks writers are so romantic and envies them or worships them or wants to know every little detail about their lives if it's a favorite writer. And to me, the role of the reader, which I think is a creative role, is not just simply that of an audience, is so uncelebrated and unsung and so sort of beautiful and trusting, you know, the way that you just sort of open your mind up to an author. There's something so intimate about letting this other person's words and images into your head or allowing them to combine with the images that are already in your head to create something new. And I, you know, people just don't appreciate readers. And as a result, there's fewer and fewer of them, apparently. And I wanted to sort of give the experience of reading its due, you know, to describe it as being so full and so rich and so complicated and in a way that no one really acknowledges. And the only way I could really do that was to describe how my reading of these particular the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but all of the Chronicles of Narnia evolved over time. You know, there was the way I read as a child, the way I read as a kind of disillusioned adolescent, and then the way I read as a true adult, that they're all so different. And because I could take the same books through those years, and I had a different relationship to them at different stages in my life and my maturing as a reader, it just seemed the perfect sort of test case to use.
There's a nice little symmetry in the fact that C.S. Lewis, I guess you discovered as you were going along that he wrote about the life of the reader, the experience of reading, and his criticism must have been a really nice surprise that reading that.
That was like one of the great things about writing The Magician's Book was just, you know, I thought, well, you know, I had read the Chronicles and then I had read like a little of the Apologetics, which are these religious works, and I didn't really like those. And I didn't really know his criticism because between his fiction and then his religious writings, both of which are pretty popular, the criticism sort of fell by the wayside, even though that was really C.S. Lewis's main life's work. You know, his main profession was as a literary scholar. He wrote this criticism that is sort of kind of out of time. You know, it's sort of outside of all of the fashions of literary criticism of his day and of all the generations since then. But it is so, one, beautifully written. I mean, he was a great natural stylist, and so so generous and just the feeling of an imagination and a mind and a heart just opening and opening to almost any book. I mean, he was a really great reader, a really omnivorous, constant reader who read almost everything and who was really any writer's ideal reader, because he could be kind of prejudiced and narrow-minded as a person, and not always as generous as a person as he could have been. But as a reader, he was always willing to give the author everything that he had. He brought everything to the book. He gave every book a fighting chance. Hmm.
Laura Miller, her book is The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventure in Narnia. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the literary critic Laura Miller is with us to talk about stories and their power. Miller is the co-founder of Salon.com. She's written a book that unpacks her childhood obsession with The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. The book is an exploration of why she's still captivated by Narnia, even as a non-believer. It's also about the pleasure of books when we're young and how they shape us. The book is called The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventure in Narnia. Here's an email from Michael, who writes, I recently enjoyed Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy as a sort of anti-Narnia. He wants to know, Laura Miller, whether you encountered Pullman's criticism of C.S. Lewis and what you think of the books. Pullman's a big part of your book, or at least was an influence.
Yes, he is. He is. I wrote a profile of Philip Pullman for The New Yorker, and so as a result, I did a lot of long interviews with him, and we became friendly, and we talked about C.S. Lewis a lot. One of the things that really inspired The Magician's Book was an idea that I encountered in His Dark Materials, which is something that he adapted from a German writer named von Kleist, and that's the idea that when you have a certain, there are things that you can do as a child that because you're so unselfconscious, you have this beautiful unselfconscious grace that we could call innocence. Yeah. And I think the narrative that a lot of us tell ourselves is that then we lose that innocence and it's just kind of all downhill from there. But what one of the characters in Philip's books tells the girl who's the heroine of those books is that, you know, there's this skill that you have that you could do without thinking about it so perfectly when you were a child, and you don't have that anymore. Mm. But if you work at it, if you work at it all your life and you really practice, eventually you will be even better at it. Mm. And it's the idea that you know, there's a kind of a beauty to innocence, but there is something about experience that has its own beauty as well if you embrace it. If you always view experience as a loss of innocence, then yes, you know, all life is paradise lost. But if you understand that there's another way into paradise, which involves just embracing your experience and seeing how far it can go and how much you can learn about the world, that has its own beauty that is equal to the beauty of innocence. And so that's sort of the plan that I followed with The Magician's Book. I said, you know, if I am never going to recapture that incredible total absorption and belief I had as a child the first time I read these books, what will I find if I try to learn everything about them that I can, and then that my encounter with them will be you know, the opposite of innocent. I will just know as much or have as much experience as I could possibly bring to that meeting.
Michael, thanks very much. Email address radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to talk about one of the first stories you say that you found to be true and, as you say, really sad. And it was this chapter from in Mary Poppins by P.L. Travers. And there's this moment where the infant twins, John and Barbara Banks, you don't see them much in the Disney movie, but you talk about how they can understand the language of the wind and the sunlight. And even a starling on the window, but the bird tells them this devastating thing that soon they're going to forget all of this. Talk a little bit about that. What did you think about that story? What bothered you about that?
Well, of course, that is the classic story of the loss of innocence, and it was so melancholy when I read that as a child. I just want to stop here and say that for anyone who has not read P.L. Travers's Mary Poppins books, you are missing some of the really the most elegant, witty, imaginative English prose there is out there. And anyone who likes Neil Gaiman, which is a lot of people, he lists her as a major influence on his own style. They're so much better than that movie.
Right. Yeah.
Just say.
And so different.
Yes, so different. They're babies. They're twin babies, and they're under a year old. And the thing that happens when you turn around the time you turn one is that you start to acquire language. Yeah. And once you join the company of the animals who speak, what Travers is saying is once you learn to become part of that community of human beings who speak to each other, communicate with each other, you sort of lose your unselfconscious ability to understand everything in the world around you in quite the same way, the inanimate objects and the animals and the birds. And, of course, there's one person who's never lost that ability, who is, of course, Mary Poppins.
Right, of course.
But everyone else, the starling explains to the children, is you'll forget. You'll forget me. You'll forget how to understand me. You'll forget how to understand the wind and the sunshine and everything else. And the children are so upset and they cry and they say, no, we won't. No, we won't. Won't. No, we won't. And of course they do. It's like Puff the Magic Dragon, but only it's babies right. instead of kids. Instead of the kids who grow out of their fairy stories, it's the babies who literally grow out of that kind of animal-like state of having no language. Mm. And there is some truth to that. You know, language really does change our consciousness, as cognitive scientists can attest. Yeah. It changes the shape of our brains and the types of memories that we have. And it's a very famous thing, even with written language, that cultures that have elaborate oral histories where they memorize these huge epic poems about gods and heroes, as soon as writing is introduced into those cultures, they lose the ability to retain those long stories. I mean, you know, even just going from spoken language to written language, you do kind of lose that incredible memory that the oral storytellers had. So, you know, language is what our brains are made of. And once it becomes a human brain, it becomes aware of itself, it thinks about itself, and then it's different from everything else in creation. We have this consciousness that nothing else has.
Mm. And it introduces us, as you say in the book, to context and what you say is our most implacable enemy. It introduces us to the idea of time.
Yes. Yes. Well, we are the one animal that knows it's going to die.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the most sort of terrifying loss of innocence of all of them. You know, on the other hand, that knowledge enables us to appreciate the life that we have if we allow it. You know, if we acknowledge it, if we embrace that knowledge, we do have a deeper and a richer appreciation of how precious life is. But it takes a certain amount of courage to do that. And sort of growing up is the process of sort of making those such difficult steps, you know, and leaving behind that simple way. I mean, children always have stories about talking animals, and my belief is partly that children identify with animals, but also that we sort of remember that once we were like them, once we were like the cat or the dog, and we didn't need words and we weren't separated from the rest of creation by words. But, we don't fantasize about losing the ability to speak. We fantasize about bringing them along with us, which, of course, would only ruin it for them.
Do you remember the moment or the particular time when you realized, wait a minute, this is about religion? He's putting a Christian theme. Do you remember that time when you first felt disillusioned and, as you put it, betrayed?
Yes, I do. I was raised as a Catholic, so I had a pretty extensive religious education. It wasn't that traditional of a Catholic education. It was fairly liberal-minded, but nevertheless, I went to catechism and read these sort of children's versions of the Gospels. And I didn't like it, and I didn't really like church, and it felt like something that was imposed upon me. And so I had always thought of Narnia as being just this beautiful thing that was separate from all of that. Yeah. It was separate from all of the kind of drab and oppressive things about the world that I lived in. And so one day I was reading probably the first work of adult literary criticism that I ever read, which was a book called Imaginary Worlds by a science fiction writer named Lynn Carter. Yeah. And it was like a survey of the history of fantasy. There was this big fantasy boom in the 70s when the Tolkien novels became hugely successful, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit.
Right.
And people started republishing the sort of early influences on Tolkien and the sort of other kinds of British and Irish fantasy fiction that preceded him. And so I was trying to find out about more books like that. And so this was a history, and he got to the point where he was talking about Lewis and Tolkien, who were very close friends. And he just casually referred to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe being the Christian story. And this light bulb went on in my head. I was like, oh, I can't believe it. It's true, I'm laughing now, as many people do, because pretty much everyone I've ever met who loved these books as a child did not realize that they had a religious significance unless an adult told them that, in advance or, shortly afterwards.
But why? I mean, that's why. Why is it? Because almost everyone feels that way.
Well, it's partly because when you're that young, you don't have the body of experience of stories. You every story is like something somebody is telling you about something that really happened. Mm. You're not sort of putting it in a group of tales that you have been told that have similar patterns to them. I mean, you can't see the similar patterns because you don't have enough data to work with. You haven't been told enough stories to go, oh, this is one of those stories where they get three wishes, or this is one of those stories where, she's always trying to get home and, or she leaves home and then she's always trying to get back again.
It just is the story.
Yeah, it just is. It just is, which is, of course, one of the things that people really miss about their childhood reading is that they don't have the kind of distance that it takes to identify, rhetorical tricks and narrative patterns and genres and, this is a detective story. I mean, what was the first detective story you ever read? I mean, you didn't know the formula and you didn't know. Maybe you didn't know the murderer would get caught. So it was just a discovery. I didn't have the kind of the experience, really, to use that word again, to know that it was the same story in different clothes. But on the other hand, also as a child, I was able to see the trees as well as the forest. See, sometimes as an adult, all you see is the forest. You don't see the bark and the leaves of each individual tree. You lose a certain experience of beauty because you're constantly trying to generalize and figure out which group and slot and idea goes with everything that you see. Whereas with a child, it's just, how could that be the same story if Aslan was a lion and Jesus was a man? Yeah. Narnia to me was a book about talking animals, which has nothing to do with the Gospels. So, you know, I saw the surface as you know, rather than the underlying pattern. But the surface is just as valid as the underlying pattern. And sometimes when adults dismiss the Chronicles of Narnia as merely being, you know, that the only meaning they can have is religious, it's because they think the only meaning is in that the repetition of those patterns from these religious stories. They don't see that there's as much meaning in a talking animal or a, you know, the fur of the lion or the you know, the dancing trees as there is in the idea of death and rebirth.
There's this moment in the book that seemed really sad to me about you talk about losing your affection for Aslan, at least for a time. Aslan, of course, the lion, who's intended, I guess, C.S. Lewis, is a god or Christ figure. And you said for a time he seemed less a character, or seems, is how you put it in present tense, seems less a character now than a creaking device. And I wondered, was that hard to lose that affection? I mean, did you mourn for a time that character, at least for a while, lost its power? Does that make sense?
It does and it doesn't. It has to do with the whole narrative that I sort of went through in my relationship to Narnia. There were things that I didn't appreciate about the books then that blossomed for me now. And so Aslan, I didn't need a daddy. You know, I don't need a daddy anymore, and that's what he is. And you know, that was, you know, the feeling of that beautiful warm and the kind of intense sensuality of the lion for the children in that book. I appreciate that without really wanting to be there the way that I did when I was a little girl and I could identify with Lucy and Susan. They have a beautiful romp with him and towards the end of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
That's a lovely piece of writing, by the way. I love that part of the book. For you. You talk about the scene as this untrammeled joy, this idea of being blissfully sensual. And I hadn't really thought of it in those ways before. It was really lovely.
It is so sensual, and because it's sort of it's erotic in a non-sexual way, sense. And so it doesn't have any of the, you know, every adult has a certain amount of ambivalence about sexuality. It's such a complicated and often fraught and sometimes dark experience, along as well as a joyful and intimate experience. And of course, it's tied up with death because it's tied up with birth. And you don't really know that when you're a kid. And there's this way that you can just sort of enjoy your senses without the sort of ambivalence of sexuality playing really any part in it. And that's really what they're having, you know. I mean, even C.S. Lewis didn't make his god a man. I mean, if Aslan was like an adult man and he was doing these, you know, rolling around with these little girls, it would be weird. It would be disturbing. And so just by making him a lion, I mean, you see in that moment that there's something about childhood and the purity of the physical experience of childhood. And I always have trouble with that because I don't want to say that sexuality is impure, but it's just so complex, and that you really have kind of, again, a self-conscious relationship to it that you don't have with your physicality when you're a child.
Laura Miller is with us. Her book is The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Laura Miller is with us talking about her book, The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventures in Narnia. We should say it's just out in paperback. And Laura Miller, I wanted to ask you about It's interesting. On one hand, there's that image of C.S. Lewis as this Christian apologist, which of course he was. But then you also talked about Narnia as being, or at least you saw it for a time and maybe still do, as Christianity's antidote, that his idea of Christianity was different from in some ways.
Well, I think of him as someone who had to come to terms with a lot of his own sort of difficulties with Christianity. He was raised in an Anglo-Irish household in Belfast, and he wrote that he just never found the religion of his childhood very appealing, and he attributed a lot of that to just the aesthetics of it, you know, the music and the architecture of the churches. And I kind of get the impression also the sort of paraphernalia of the Gospels. I think of him as being someone who has a hard time relating to that sort of Middle Eastern setting. You know, his imagination was really captured by Norse mythology and Celtic folklore, which he got from his Irish nurse when he was a little boy. And he went through an atheist period until he was about 30. But there was this long period where he was studying medieval and Renaissance literature, and all of the writers that he loved, and a lot of his friends were Christians. And so he was sort of moving towards Christianity. But he was just having really a hard time because he felt like he had to let go of these other things that felt so beautiful and meaningful to him, like classical mythology and Norse mythology and fairy tales and a lot of pagan culture that was really, really important to him. And his friendship with J.R.R. Tolkien really helped him convert. You know, it helped him sort of make that conversion. But I think that helped him believe that he could keep his love for those things and still be a Christian. But I think that he continued through his life to sort of try to make – to bring all of that together, to convince himself that a story about witches and giants and dwarves and magic and dragons could be compatible with Christianity. And there's a whole – the Middle Eastern monotheistic religions have a totally different paint box from the Northern European pagan religions. And he sort of emotionally, he responded to the Northern European paint box, but, you know, he wanted to believe in the subject matter of the Middle Eastern monotheists. So he sort of, merge them with each other. And to me, that's what Narnia is. I mean, if you believed that the story of God's relationship to man that appears in the Bible is really the perfect way to tell that meaning, you know, that story is a perfect way to tell that meaning, then you don't actually ever really need to retell it with lion and fauns and satyrs and, you know, naiads and dryads dancing in the green veils of Narnia. You know, that because the Gospels tells it the best possible way. You don't need another way. But I think that some part of him always yearned for those old things, or what in the British Isles was often called the old religion. I mean, when the Protestant Church displaced the Catholic Church, Catholicism was referred to as the old religion. But before the Christian conversions, there were the old religions of that place, either the Norse infused religions with the Anglo-Saxons or the Celtic mythology. And so there's always sort of an old religion behind the current religion. And he, like a lot of people in that part of the world, had this really strong attachment to that old religion and wanted to sort of get them all together and believe that they were all compatible. So I think what I responded to as a child was that old religion, the all of those pagan motifs and the settings, the sort of forested settings and the heather and the heaths and that feeling, that Northern European feeling or that Celtic feeling, you know, that was what I was really captured my imagination.
And Tolkien hated it. I mean, he hated all of those different elements coming into the story. He was looking for something more pure, I guess, in terms of all of those.
Yeah. I mean, they had such different personalities. I mean, they had some of the same – they had similar yearnings. I mean, they both were really, really captivated by Northern European pagan culture, but Tolkien was this kind of obsessive compulsive purist who liked to create systems. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I love The Lord of the Rings, and some people have mistaken my book, the criticism of that book in my book for a dissing of The Lord of the Rings. But I love it. But to a certain degree. You know, Middle Earth is like this giant model railroad set, like the ultimate, you know, imaginary model railroad set with every little detail is sort of perfect and all worked out. And Tolkien hated the fact that Lewis mixed up classical mythology, Greek and Roman mythology with, you know, sort of fairy tale stuff, with sort of Norse stuff, with the Christian theme. And then he had Santa Claus and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I think was the last straw for Tolkien, you know, because Santa is sort of like this pop culture, modern pop culture figure. And he thought that you needed to create like almost an entire independent reality, which is what Middle Earth was, with its own consistent, unique languages and beliefs and cultures and, you know, all of that stuff. You know, he really wanted it to be like that. Mm. And Lewis was like his operative, you know, sort of principle was that, you know, he was just going to put everything he loved in there, and he was going to take a little from here. It was like a smorgasbord,
right.
And you know, that just went just totally rubbed Tolkien's fur the wrong way.
Here's an email from Michael, writes from Davis County in Utah. He writes, I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a young boy, and didn't see the religious elements until I read about the final battle in a later book. However, no adult told me the religious elements were there. Unlike Laura Miller, I was much more accepting and an acting participant in my religious upbringing. Here's his question. Do you believe that your faith or your lack of faith caused your disillusionment with the stories?
Yeah, I think, you know, that I experienced religion as a child as something that adults were constantly trying to foist on me, something unpleasant that adults were constantly trying to impose upon me. And I saw C.S. Lewis and the Narnia books as sort of my friends and allies in resisting that adult campaign. And so when, you know, I have to admit, I was like as old as 13 before this, I realized that, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I felt that he had been secretly conspiring with the adult, you know, forces behind my back. And that made me, you know, so upset and sort of, you know, disgusted and betrayed. I mean, part of it was the reaction of that I had, you know, I wasn't really a believer anymore, and I didn't like church, and I wasn't interested in Christianity, and so part of it was that, but part of it was also just that I was angry at myself for having been deceived as I saw it. I mean, it made me feel stupid, which is something you never want to do with a teenager. So, you know, that turned me off of the books for a really long time. Now, I know people who, you know, there was a religious continuity that they had good experiences with religion, like the novelist Jonathan Franzen, who I interviewed, who had, on the whole, a very benign experience with religion, although he's not now himself a believer anymore.
Right.
And so it felt like Narnia was a continuity with that, and it didn't bother him. But because I had – enough negative feelings about my own religious upbringing. I just felt like that's why I felt betrayed, is that, you know, this thing that was my private thing had actually been contaminated by this adult, sort of this no fun adult authority.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to sort of get over that adolescent rejection and to realize, well, you can, you know, I had to be in college and reading The Divine Comedy and realizing, well, you know, I don't actually have to believe in this cosmology to find this poem incredibly beautiful and powerful. Mm. So, you know, it just took me forever to sort of realize I could apply the same same kind of nuances of understanding to the Narnia books.
So it seems like it's this balancing act. I mean, you have to – I think you said it sort of – it. You have to know how to read allegorically, and that's how you take it as an adult. And you can have a kind of skepticism about literature and about all these kinds of things, but it doesn't have to ruin the idea of the story, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the way that I think of it is that, you know, your childhood experiences are so pure, but your adult experiences, if you allow them to be, and if you work to make them. And so can be incredibly rich. There's just so much more that you understand. You're such a more well-developed instrument for the author to play upon. But you have to allow that to happen. You know, you can't just cling to that childhood simplicity because that's gone. And so to me, you know, learning how to love a book without agreeing or approving of everything in it is almost in some way the quintessence of being an adult, because I think being an adult is a great thing. I don't, you know, shun it or think it's a sad, you know, diminishment of my life. You know, I think being an adult is in its own way as beautiful a thing as being a child, but you have to allow yourself to see it. And so, you know, I feel like even the religious parts of the Chronicles of Narnia, I can now see the parts of them that I think are lovely and not have the parts that I don't like sort of spoil it. And that to me is maturity. And I think actually it's the same in how you feel about people. You learn to love somebody while acknowledging their faults as well as their strengths.
Laura Miller. Her book is The Magician's Book, A Skeptic's Adventure in Narnia. It's just out in paperback. Laura Miller, thanks very much for the time.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.